Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
After a major typhoon, the Philippines is dealing with flooding and a corruption scandal sparked by allegations of misused funding for flood prevention.
We've had corruption scandals in the past, but not to the extent that it has damaged the lives of people.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also, the best known political prisoner in Egypt is now free after years behind bars.
It's great that Alaa is free. It's wonderful. It was an incredible injustice for him to be detained.
But thousands of others are still locked up in Egyptian jails.
And the South Korean welcome toward North Korea and defectors from the North, it's cooling off.
My identity as a North Korean defector is not shameful.
Plus, an effort at the United Nations to find Ukrainian children kidnapped by Russia. That is all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. Two major conflicts are top of mind at the United Nations General Assembly this week: the wars in Gaza and in Ukraine. President Trump addressed UN delegates today at UN headquarters and said he had thought Ukraine would be the easiest war to end, but he said that Russia's President Vladimir Putin has proved to be recalcitrant. Trump also mocked Putin's management of the war.
It was supposed to be just a quick little skirmish. It's not making Russia look good. It's making them look bad. No matter what happens from here on out, this was something that should have taken a matter of days, certainly less than a week. And they've been fighting for 3.5 years.
A short time later, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky took part in a summit at the UN organized by Canada. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney laid out the need for the conference.
Putin has stolen Ukrainian children. Thousands of children have been abducted by Russia. Russia has repeatedly targeted the most vulnerable groups of children, including orphans, children with disabilities, children from poor families.
The World's Shirin Jafari was at that conference in New York today, and she joined us to tell us more.
Well, the reason Canada organized this event, Marco, was because it wants to raise attention to the missing children of Ukraine, specifically children who have been taken by Russia. The Ukrainian government estimates that about 20,000 of them have been forcibly transferred since 2022. But experts tell me that that's an undercount, and the figure is more like 35,000. President Zelensky was his usual self today. He was wearing his military-themed outfit, and that's, you know, what he's been wearing since the beginning of the war. And he had a clear message for the audience.
The crime must be stopped. The felons must be held accountable. Ukrainian children must be brought home.
In addition to Zelensky and the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, both of the first ladies of Ukraine and Canada spoke today as well. And they drew on the themes of motherhood and the fact that the safety and well-being of children must be a priority for everybody across the world. And they both gave examples of children whose lives were turned upside down because of, you know, having been abducted by Russia. Here's Olena Zelenska, Ukraine's first lady, speaking about that.
If one child were abducted, we would be outraged and demand justice. But what if an entire state, using its institutions and army, abducts not one, but thousands of children?
And Marco, you could tell that this is a very emotional topic for both of these first ladies.
Yeah, no, that's evident. Shirin, how do these children end up in Russia or Russian-controlled areas?
There are different ways that they end up there. They're either taken by force when Russian soldiers take over their towns and cities, and their parents are killed in attacks. And then some of them are sent by their families, teachers, or local community leaders. But you know, they're sent for what is meant to be a temporary period of time, like for a summer camp, but then Russia doesn't allow them to return. And then some of these children are in state institutions, like orphanages, and they are basically scooped up and taken away when their cities or towns are taken over by Russian forces.
Awful situation, and honestly one that we don't hear nearly enough about. So this has been going on for a while, as you said, Shirin. What is the goal of this kind of conference at the UN?
So the goal is to draw attention and to get the help of powerful leaders like President Trump to get these children back home. Now, I have to emphasize that abducting children and re-educating them, which is what Russia is doing, is against international law. And in fact, in March 2023, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Putin and Russia's Commissioner for Children's Rights, Maria Lvova-Belova, for alleged war crimes. So that was the first step towards accountability. Now, today's session at the United Nations comes just a few days after a new report by war crimes investigators revealed that the problem of abduction of these children is much worse than what we previously knew about.
Yeah, how so, Shirin? What does the report say?
So these researchers initially thought that there are 115 sites in Russia where Ukrainian children are held, but then they found that, in fact, that number is 210. Nathaniel Raymond heads the humanitarian research lab at Yale School of Public Health, and he was involved in the research.
This case is the single largest kidnapping of children since World War II in war.
When I spoke to him recently, Raymond told me that there are different types of quote-unquote camps for these children in Russia. There are ones where the focus is on re-education, meaning that children are not allowed to speak Ukrainian and they're educated in Russian and they have to speak Russian. Otherwise, he told me that in some cases, they are given a solitary confinement as punishment if they do that. He said that the youngest child that he knows about that is in these programs was just 4 months old, Marco, when he was captured in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And then some of these children end up in camps that train them for military purposes.
That can include literal training in combat tactics. Some were sent to a paratrooper jump school. Others we can even see from space are at locations with shooting ranges, while others are sent to what's called cadet corps programs.
These are really young children, and you can understand why this is so concerning for researchers and war crimes investigators.
Yeah, really shocking. So from solitary confinement to military training, how was Nathaniel Raymond and the other researchers at Yale able to learn this? Because obviously they can't just go to these camps and see what's going on, right?
Yeah, exactly. That is one of the challenges when it comes to researching and verifying the facts of this story, is that they can't access these sites. But they use satellite images and Russian government documents to verify and find out about these sites. They also used officials' social media posts, Russian officials' social media posts about this, and they verified the location of these camps with five other independent sources. That's what Raymond told me.
Is there any evidence that the children who get military training actually end up on the battlefield?
Raymond said that so far they don't have concrete evidence that is the case. Like, they don't have any bodies of children from the battlefield or their tags or any sort of reliable evidence that they are being sent to front lines. But he said what we can tell from these satellite images and all of the information they've been able to gather is that the type of training that they are being given is the type that you would give soldiers and you would send them to front lines. So there is a great possibility that they are, in fact, being sent or planned to be sent to front lines.
So now that the world knows about these sites, Shirin, what happens now?
Well, President Volodymyr Zelensky today said that he wants to see more accountability, that the issue of these children cannot be forgotten and set aside. But the researchers, like Raymond, face challenges. And one of them, Marco, is that the United States has imposed sanctions on individuals at the International Criminal Court. And that has complicated the work of these war crimes researchers.
There's been extreme confusion about whether the sanctions against the ICC puts American organizations at risk for sharing information on Ukraine, Sudan, and other cases not related to Israel-Palestine.
And Raymond said that his team decided to list all of these locations in their report publicly so that they could provide this information quickly and effectively to prosecutors at the ICC without risking violating U.S. sanctions.
The world, Shirin Jafari, speaking with me from a busy day at the UN General Assembly. Shirin, thank you very much for telling us about this.
You're welcome, Marco.
And now the story of a disappearing mountain. Okay, actually one view of a mountain that could vanish. Mont Sainte-Victoire is in France. The mountain was made famous by the 19th century impressionist painter Paul Cézanne. The painter captured light and shadow on the mountain's rocky ridges in dozens of landscapes. But that iconic view may someday only exist in his art. The world's Jerry Haddon brings us the story from Aix-en-Provence, France.
Paul Cézanne once said, "I walk in nature every day because the views are magnificent." One of the views the French painter loved most was of Sainte-Victoire, the limestone ridge that looms over the southern city. Cézanne painted around 80 different portraits of Sainte-Victoire, says Didier Bonfort. Bonfort leads an association called Protect Cézanne's Landscapes. He's brought me to a green plateau some 5 miles from the mountain, where, he says, Cézanne often set up his easel. And no wonder, he says, depending on the light and the time of year, the fields and hills leading to Sainte-Victoire can become purple with lavender or dotted with red and yellow flowers. Cézanne, says Bonfort, captured it all. On this very spot alone, he says, Cézanne made 52 versions of the mountain in oil, watercolor, sketches. Bonfort pulls out a print of one portrait from a manila folder he carries. The original was at one point owned by late Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. For me, this is one of the most beautiful renderings of Sainte-Victoire, Bonfort says. Yes, I say, but it's strange because in it, the mountain isn't really the protagonist. Stealing the show is the foreground, the delicate light in the trees, the shadows in the fields. That's exactly why it's so important to protect this area, Bonfort says. All the colors you see captured in the painting will disappear, he says. This is what we're defending. Defending from a proposed housing project called La Constance, where now there is nature, La Constance would deliver 3,600 new apartments in high buildings, an office park, and a shopping mall. Bonfort says the city of Aix loved to promote Cézanne, its most famous son, but it won't protect him. City officials disagree.
Donc les vues cézanniennes dans ce projet ont été totalement préservées.
Speaking to local TV, Aix's planning commissioner, Jean-Louis Vincent, said Cézanne is at the heart of the housing development. The view of Sainte-Victoire, he said, will be preserved. Technically, that's true, but at just one spot. According to project plans, the sole viewpoint won't be much more than a sliver between two new buildings. Right now, you can see the mountain from everywhere. But it's not as if Aix officials don't understand the value of a view.
Un sanctuaire de biodiversité où chaque panorama raconte une histoire millénaire.
This is a government-made video promoting tourism around Sainte-Victoire. It's much more than just a mountain, the narrator says. It's a sanctuary for biodiversity with centuries of history contained in each view. The problem for the city, officials say, is a really bad housing shortage, especially for young people. It needs to build new homes. Is a mountain view, no matter how immortalized it may be, more important than affordable housing for all? In downtown Aix-en-Provence, university student Camille Aswada is on her way to work. She tells me she'd vote for cheaper housing any day.
Moi, de mon côté, je fais de l'alternance. Donc, je travaille 3 jours en entreprise et 2 jours en école.
My story is typical, she says. I'm holding down 2 jobs while I study at the local university. Some students might be lucky enough to get financial support from their parents, she says. Otherwise, you live in a shoebox. Aswara says she pays about $720 US a month for a 15-by-15-foot studio. The Association to Protect Cézanne's Landscapes says it isn't against new housing, but it says there are other plots of land where the city could build without harming its cultural heritage. Sainte-Victoire, the mountain, is protected under French law. Activists are hopeful a lawsuit they filed will save the view, too. In 2023, judges stopped a wind turbine project in northern France. It was too close, they ruled, to the home of another beloved French artist, the writer Marcel Proust. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Aix-en-Provence, France.
Coming up, the Philippines is dealing with the aftermath of a major typhoon and, at the same time, a corruption scandal centered on funding for flood control projects. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Southeast Asia, a super typhoon is whipping its way towards southern China. Shenzhen, Hong Kong, and Macau could all get hit. For the past day, Typhoon Ragasa, as it's called internationally, battered the northern Philippines with winds over 160 miles an hour.
Simply put, this is the biggest storm in the world right now. Thousands of people in the Philippines have been evacuated. Video from the Philippines shows first responders in rafts helping people get to safety. Ronald Holmes is a political scientist at De La Salle University in Manila. We spoke earlier today, and he started by telling us about the areas damaged by the storm so far.
The damage still has to be determined, but definitely the northern provinces, Cagayan, even the province of the president, Ilocos Norte, and the northernmost province, Batanes, have been severely affected. There are flooded areas there.
So the typhoon comes at the same time that a corruption scandal is playing out in the Philippines. It's called Floodgate. What sparked that scandal and now the ongoing demonstrations there?
Well, basically, the scandal has been brought about by flood control projects that are found to be either inexistent, substandard, and allegation right now is there's a collusion between contractors, heads of the agencies of the Department of Public Works, and legislators. And the president himself has called for an investigation. And because of the recent spate of typhoons that have caused flooding in the area, people have really signaled an outrage. And we had mass protests in the last few days.
So, Ronald, I'm seeing that there are reports suggesting that over $2 billion in taxpayer money was lost to these bogus flood resilience projects over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's anger over taxpayers supporting these flood mitigation projects, and in many cases, there was no project. Did officials pocket the money? Like, is there evidence that happened?
Well, there are now investigations happening in the Senate, as well as an independent commission, and the testimonies of those who were involved with the projects themselves indicated that there were payoffs to officials, both in the executive branch and also to legislators who sponsored as earmarked the projects that are either inexistent or really substandard. Certain senators and members of the lower house, the House of Representatives, have been identified.
How bad was the flooding in the Philippines over the summer?
Well, really bad. Too bad that it caused the cancellation of work and the suspension of learning or classes at all levels. There were certain areas, for example, that flooding basically caused a suspension for about 3 or 4 days of work as well as classes. And these were areas that were supposed were a number of the flood control projects were supposed to be working. So it is essentially indicated that those projects really were substandard, not up to the level that would really control the flooding. Of course, flooding happens in many countries, but the amount of rainfall and the spate of typhoons as well as the southwest monsoon made it clear that those projects were flawed to begin with.
Are activists saying if there had been the infrastructure in place that had been earmarked for flood mitigation, the damage this past summer would not have been as bad?
It should have not been that bad. The floods would have receded much more faster. But what has happened is that in certain areas in the metropolis that have not seen flooding over the past years, suddenly the flooding came about, and then it took about a couple of days for some of the floods to recede. There's still an area in some of the provinces that are really flood-prone. They've been underwater for about a month. And in one province, for example, which is now the subject of investigation, the Senate, many of the residents were protesting the other day, and the flood was still knee-deep. Those are floodwaters that came about 2 weeks ago. So that's the extent of really profligacy that we saw on the part of the legislators who were supposed to be sponsoring those projects and the implementers in the Department of Public Works.
Right. Well, and now we're seeing the initial damage from the biggest storm in the world. How would you describe the connection between the protests that you've been talking about and Super Typhoon Ragasa that's now heading towards southern China from the Philippines?
Well, essentially the typhoon and all the other typhoons that came in over the past month made it very clear the cause of corruption in the Philippines. We've had corruption scandals in the past, but not to the extent that it has damaged the lives of people. This time around, definitely there are more people that have been affected by the typhoons. And since these projects were supposed to lessen the impact, the deleterious impact of flooding and typhoons, it has been clear to them, and that's the reason for the outrage, that the government has really not responded to a problem that we were supposed to expect, being really affected so much by climate change.
Hmm. There is no shortage of major news in the Philippines. The former president, Rodrigo Duterte, has been now officially charged with crimes against humanity at the International Criminal Court in The Hague after his arrest and extradition from the Philippines earlier this year. He's facing 3 counts of charges related to murders committed by his government and his anti-drug campaign. Is the Duterte news in The Hague converging with the corruption news back in Manila?
It is. Basically, there are 2 issues that are really at the top of the mind of people. Both issues require accountability on the part of those involved in the floodgate scandal, and accountability with regard to the Dutertes because of the crimes against humanity and misuse of funds on the part of the vice president, because she still has to answer the use of the confidential funds, which is the subject of an impeachment case filed against her.
It's an interesting moment when it comes to government corruption. We've also seen protest movements in Nepal and Indonesia and now the Philippines, all centered on a similar theme of corruption. What do you make of that?
Well, I would say that the protests and the outrage in the Philippines to a certain extent would be influenced by what we saw in Indonesia and Nepal. However, at this point in time, we don't see that much of civil unrest or insurrection in the Philippines. Perhaps that will come if there is inaction still on the part of government, if they do not pursue the floodgate scandal and get to the bottom of who should be answerable for all of those inexistent or substandard projects.
Ronald Holmes is a political scientist at De La Salle University in the Philippines capital, Manila.
Medical experts and public health officials are speaking up today after President Trump told pregnant women not to take Tylenol.
Trump also made a misleading claim connecting the common painkiller with autism that is not backed up by science.
Rebuttals to the president's comments were prolific across the United Kingdom this morning, where Tylenol is called paracetamol.
Studies that take into account the effect of family show that there is no link between autism and taking paracetamol when pregnant.
That's Bryony Dean Franklin, a professor of medicine at University College London, speaking to ITV News. That same point was made clear by Britain's drugs regulator, MHRA. Dr. Alison Cave is the chief safety officer and says paracetamol remains the recommended pain reliever during pregnancy and that untreated pain or fevers can be risky for both mother and baby.
Cave said her agency's advice is based on rigorous assessment of the best available scientific evidence, or as Franklin put it succinctly in that ITV interview,
paracetamol is definitely the safest painkiller to use.
You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada. taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Machu Picchu is on many travelers' bucket lists. It is the legendary citadel of the Inca people high up in the Andes. It was built in the 15th century and later abandoned. This month, hundreds of visitors found themselves stuck there, unable to leave. A fight over bus contracts sparked protests and roadblocks. The group that named Machu Picchu one of the new wonders of the world says its status could now be at risk. The World's Latin America correspondent, Tibi Saizea, has more.
What should be a dream trip turned into a nightmare for many tourists in Machu Picchu last week. Nearly 1,600 visitors were caught in demonstrations that shut down transport. Some people were stuck at the site, others couldn't reach it. A tourist from Mexico spoke to a local TV station about his frustration. It is very disappointing, he said. We came all this way spending so much money and had to leave without seeing the site. Protesters blocked the only train line into Aguascalientes, the town at the base of the Inca citadel. At one point, more than 1,000 tourists were evacuated from Machu Picchu, and about 900 remained stranded there for days. The unrest began when the only bus company that ran the route for decades saw its concession expire. Officials from the Ministry of Culture then awarded the contract to a new operator, but some locals say the process wasn't fair and they blocked the new company from starting service. It's a fight for money. Everyone wants control of the buses, said Carlos Quaresma, a resident speaking to reporters. The standoff and lost tourism revenue cost up to $2 million a day, according to Peru's Ministry of Tourism. Economist Jaime Dupuy from the business group Comex says the bus fight is only part of a bigger problem.
Pero al final no terminas de solucionar el problema general que es una mala gestión global del santuario de Machu Picchu.
The real problem, he says, is poor management of the sanctuary, with frequent complaints about overcrowding, the way tickets are sold, and lack of planning and regulations.
Hay muchas personas que ya no están viniendo, operadores internacionales que ya están sacando.
He says some international tour operators have already stopped including Peru in their itineraries. For many locals, the crisis feels personal. Moisés Bendezú Sandoval, a restaurant owner in the area, led the campaign that helped the site win its Wonder title in 2007.
La campaña en sí lo hice solventado exclusivamente con dineros de mi restaurante.
It was a seven-year campaign that he paid for from the profits of his restaurant.
Nos da mucha tristeza que va lo utilicen a Machu Picchu para intereses particulares.
It makes me very sad to see Machu Picchu fought over by private interest, he says. Last week, in a public statement, the New Seven Wonders Foundation, the group that organized the global vote in 2007, warned Machu Picchu could lose its title. I spoke with Jean-Paul de la Fuente, the foundation's director.
When the people themselves, not only just visitors, tourists, but also locals, start to say, is it credible that this place, in frankly such a mess, could continue to be called a wonder, that's when we put it into question.
He says this is the first time any wonder has faced such a warning.
It's also the first one ever that we went out of our way to make constructive proposals from already 5 years ago because we saw the problem coming, sadly without any constructive response to date.
He says Peru has benefited from what's known as the wonder effect, a boom in tourism and global visibility. UNESCO, which separately recognizes Machu Picchu as a World Heritage Site, has also raised alarm about overcrowding, waste, fires, and landslides. Ana Maria Felix, a tourist guide, told reporters that drastic steps may be needed.
Y yo personalmente lo digo y públicamente que sí se quite el título de maravilla del mundo a nuestro Machu Picchu.
I personally say Machu Picchu should lose its wonder title, she says, so it can be reorganized and we can start over. For now, trains are moving and visitors are back at the site. The challenge for Peru is to find a long-term solution before Machu Picchu's reputation and its wonder status slip away. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
South Korea has suspended the Voice of Freedom. It's a long-running radio broadcast that transmitted news, information, and entertainment across the border into North Korea. Ending the broadcast is part of a wider trend in South Korea. The government in Seoul is backing away from activities that might antagonize the North. But the members of one organization in the South are not giving up trying to reach North Koreans, despite the political headwinds. Reporter Jason Strother paid them a visit in Seoul.
Many North Koreans feel embarrassed about their northern accents, but not Han Jae-dok.
Some North Korean defectors are hiding their identity. Of course, I have a North Korean accent too. My identity as a North Korean defector is not shameful.
It's a voice he's chosen to use.
오늘은 북한 사회 안전송에서
for broadcasts for the Unification Media Group, which pipes news, music, and entertainment into North Korea for 3 hours each day. Its programs are also smuggled in on SD cards across the border from China.
I thought it is very important to give information to them. They don't know how bad, you know, in what bad world they live in. And they don't know how to find out their way out.
Han is in his 40s and arrived in South Korea 3 years ago after escaping a construction site in Russia where North Korean workers earn money for Pyongyang. He's one of around a dozen North Korean refugees who work for the group and its partner news service, The Daily NK.
Yeah, it is a concern.
He gives me a tour of the recording studio where he produces his two shows. The on-air light above the soundboard is turned off as we talk.
청취자 여러분, 안녕하세요.
He plays me an interview he did with a fellow refugee who shares the story of her defection.
Every North Korean defector's story moves me, and I think it will move others too, especially North Korean people who are yet living in the slavery society.
He hopes that stories like these will help them envision and pursue freedom. But on the day I visited the station, guests in another studio were discussing a concern closer to home. Earlier this year, the Trump administration halted funding that supports some Seoul-based North Korea human rights groups, including this one. Lee Kwang-baek is the Unification Media Group's president. He says it was the biggest crisis the group has faced in its 20 years. There are two streams of U.S. funding, he explains, the State Department and the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED. It took some convincing just to get one of those back. Lee says State Department funding was restored after he explained how hard it would be to rebuild their network of contacts in North Korea if they lost it. NED funding was restored, too, by U.S. court order. Lee says U.S. grants cover close to 100% of his operating costs, and he doesn't know who would step in if their next application is rejected. But he's pretty sure it won't be the South Korean government. He says that during previous liberal administrations, the South Korean government didn't rally behind North Korea human rights groups. Sometimes, in fact, it worked against them. He expects much the same from President Lee Jae-myung.
So with each change in government and administration, you can find NGOs and civil society groups that really struggle because now suddenly they're out of step with the approach of the government.
That's John DeLory, a senior fellow at the Asia Society in Seoul. He says policy toward North Korea shifts dramatically here, depending on whether conservatives or liberals are in power. Because President Lee is signaling that he wants to engage Pyongyang after a long period of close to no dialogue, DeLory says groups that criticize North Korea for its human rights record don't align with that approach.
Well, from a South Korean government perspective, if you're trying to get along better with your northern neighbor, if you're trying to implement, in reality, on the ground, peaceful coexistence, then that means you have a hard time supporting or even allowing groups that want to actively take measures to subvert the North Korean regime, including in the information domain.
I reached out to South Korea's Unification Ministry, the department that handles North Korea policy. In an email, an official said the government does support some human rights groups, but North Koreans, quote, right to know needs to be balanced with efforts to improve inter-Korean relations. So for now, the radio station isn't planning on going silent despite all the uncertainty.
북한의 변화와 한반도의 통일을 준비합니다.
North Korean refugee and radio producer Han Jae-dok says he tries not to think about what would happen if his broadcasts did have to stop.
We are unique media. No other organs can play the same role as us.
He says it's very important to keep voices like his on the air. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
70 years ago, China named the western region of Xinjiang an autonomous part of the People's Republic. Today, Chinese leader Xi Jinping made a rare visit to the region. He met with representatives of different ethnic groups there and expressed hope, quote, that everyone would join forces and move forward together to build a beautiful Xinjiang. The reality is that all is not beautiful there. Hundreds of thousands of people within the ethnic Uyghur population and other Muslim groups have been subjected by the Chinese government to forced labor or sent to re-education camps. Just over the border in Kazakhstan, home to a large number of Uyghur Muslims, it is a very different picture. Reporting from the Kazakh city of Almaty, Levi Bridges brought us this story over the summer from a Uyghur community that's flourishing.
Recently, I got invited to a Uyghur wedding reception in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city. The happy couple went all out, rented a huge banquet hall, hired a dance troupe, and an ensemble of Uyghur musicians who play traditional instruments. The band's leader, Nazim Abdrimov, grew up in Kazakhstan. As a teenager, he remembers seeing Uyghur musicians on a trip to China.
Playing nonstop for 3-4 hours. And I was like under hypnosis. Hypnosis, yeah. It was really like touch me inside.
Abdrimov's parents pushed him to study science, something practical. But a university professor told him, as a Uyghur, he would never make it, a stereotype faced by ethnic minorities.
He said, you are Uyghur, you will not educate well, you will go to cafe to pull noodles.
Uyghurs face discrimination, even though they're one of the largest ethnic groups in Kazakhstan. Uyghurs have lived here for more than a century. Before the repression started in China, Abdrimov traveled to Xinjiang, the center of Uyghur culture, to learn about traditional music. And he eventually received the ultimate compliment about his music from Uyghurs in Kazakhstan.
They said, wow, you do it exactly like in our motherland.
Mm-hmm. Now, Almaty has become a kind of surrogate cultural capital for Uyghurs. The Kazakh government supports Uyghur language schools here and helps run the world's only Uyghur theater. Kazakhstan is also a majority Muslim country, so unlike China, Uyghur religious practices aren't restricted. At a Uyghur mosque I visit in Almaty, they're doing renovations, sprucing it up for the faithful. And there's the delicious food. In an Almaty restaurant, I meet Rustam Kariev, deputy chairman of the city's Uyghur Culture Center. He says, try the Uyghur tea. It's served with sour cream and plenty of salt.
Mmm, wow.
I dig into a spicy noodle dish called lagman, as Kariev explains that some Uyghur dishes acquired Chinese names over time. He says it's kind of like the U.S.-Mexico border. Lots of culinary fusion happening. Kariev says no matter how popular tacos get in the U.S., everyone knows that's Mexican food. It's the same here for Uyghur dishes. At the city's Uyghur market, traditional drums hang next to these embroidered, kind of square-shaped, four-sided hats. Saeed Maximov, a local Kazakh Uyghur, says sometimes images on these hats signify the marital status of a man's children.
So you could see from far away, say, oh, this guy has three sons, and they're not married. Let's talk about it.
It helped with matchmaking back in the day. Uyghurs have always been a minority in the distant outskirts of empires founded by Russia and China. Maximov says Uyghurs are a tight-knit community that helps each other. They regularly hold large assemblies, for example, deciding how to help the needy.
They just show that collectively they can solve almost any issue.
It sounds very democratic.
Yeah, it really sounds like democratic. And maybe this is the reason why our neighbors, like China and Russia, they try to break us down.
Some Uyghurs, like Maximov, are getting tired of being known to the world simply as a persecuted Muslim minority. For him, Uyghur traditions form a modern, vibrant culture.
It's like a real brotherhood, which is beautiful because it's a very special bond when you're going through the difficulties, through the struggles with each other.
But Islam is still a cultural bedrock for many. Kahraman Jamberdi is an Almaty native with the World Uyghur Congress. He says Islam gives Uyghurs a common identity that unites them in their struggle for freedom and independence. Back at the wedding, the bride and groom roll up in a huge SUV limo with tinted windows. The party's finally getting started. Just over the border in China, these kinds of cultural and religious celebrations are essentially banned. But here, in this thriving community in Kazakhstan, they haven't been erased. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges, Almaty, Kazakhstan.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. He helped speak for a mass movement that brought down a dictator who'd been in power for 30 years. He also paid a high price for it. Ala Abdel Fattah has spent most of the last 12 years behind bars. But last night, he went home after Egypt's president granted him a pardon. In a video from the BBC, Ala is seen celebrating with his mother and sister at the family's home in Giza, just outside of Cairo.
Abdel Fattah is probably the best-known political prisoner in Egypt. He attracted international attention during the uprising in 2011 that toppled the military dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. Political scientist Samer Shahata is an expert on Egypt at the University of Oklahoma. He told me earlier today how Abdel Fattah became so well-known in Egypt and around the world.
He is an activist, a political critic. He's a computer programmer, software developer by profession, and he became well-known as one of the youth leaders of the 2011 Egyptian uprising or revolution. However, he continued protesting in the years following the toppling of Hosni Mubarak, demanding for freedom and justice, and he was unfortunately imprisoned by subsequent regimes that came into power. His mother has British citizenship. It was bestowed on him in an effort to further pressure the government to release him. And she was also active in England, going on a hunger strike. And so there's an international dimension to the story as well.
What were the actual charges against Alaa?
Well, most recently, the charges were spreading fake news. And he posted on Facebook about the horrible prison conditions and human rights violations in Egypt. Previously, he had been imprisoned for unlawfully, or at least charged with unlawfully organizing a demonstration or a protest. And then he had been imprisoned for criticism of the military, government, and so on.
So the sentence he was serving was supposed to end in 2027. What do you make of the timing of his release? Like, why now?
It is a mystery, or there's certainly no certainty as to why he was released now. But first, President Sisi wanted to release Alaa on his own timeline, not according to pressure brought by the British or by the Americans or international human rights activists. And he did that. Secondly, I think, you know, some have speculated that this corresponds to the British recognizing the state of Palestine and so on. That could be the case. It's also the case that there's an increased tension and pressure and a war of words, as it were, between Israel and Egypt over Gaza, over the Rafah crossing and so on. Allegations that Egypt is violating the Egyptian-Israeli peace accords and so on. And so this certainly is a positive public relations step for the Egyptian government at this moment. There's no question about that.
Let's talk a bit more about the external pressure. You mentioned Alaa's 68-year-old mother, Leila Saif. She went on a hunger strike last September for 287 days advocating for his release. His two sisters, Mona and Sana Saif, they're also prominent activists. How critical was the family's advocacy in getting Alaa out of detention?
I think there's no question that particularly Leila Swaif's activism, and she went on several hunger strikes, and she was actually hospitalized, and her condition was quite critical. So that, and of course, doing that at 10 Downing Street was very important. And as you mentioned, his sisters, and perhaps particularly Sanat Saif, has been organizing in the United States, elsewhere. She brought up his issue during the COP27 environment meeting in Egypt that took place in Sharm el-Sheikh that caused quite a bit of attention and so on. And so I think the international dimension and the activism by the family and others and so on brought his case to be seen as perhaps being a liability for the Egyptian regime.
What do you think happens next with Abdel Fattah? Will he be allowed to stay in Egypt? Will he want to stay in Egypt?
I think he would want to stay, but I had always thought that if he were freed, it would be on the condition that he leaves to Britain and not come back, and in fact, perhaps even renounce his Egyptian citizenship, because that has happened in at least one other case of a dual national who was imprisoned in Egypt for political activism and so on. But so far, we've seen nothing of that sort here, and perhaps Alaa wouldn't accept that. He comes from an activist family. He is committed to the principles of freedom and democracy and human rights, and so perhaps that was something that he wasn't willing to do. We don't know at this stage.
So he was released along with five other prisoners. His family, obviously very happy. They were also insistent that they will be fully satisfied when all prisoners of conscience in Egypt are released. Is his pardon a one-off, or do you think we'll see a trickle of other releases at this point as well?
if we see anything, it might be a trickle. I think the important point is this does not represent a dramatic change in Egypt's human rights conditions or freedom for political prisoners in Egypt. That's very unlikely. So it's great that Alaa is free. It's wonderful. It was an incredible injustice for him to be detained and so on. But this doesn't represent a radical shift in the level of political freedoms in Egypt, unfortunately.
How does the younger generation of Egyptian activists see the pro-democracy struggle at this point?
You know, one unfortunate lesson is that the protests and 2011 didn't result in what was hoped for. And in fact, right. It has brought a regime that is even harsher than the one that existed before. There's no question that the levels of political freedom under the Sisi regime are much less and conditions are much harsher than under Mubarak. And so some could see it being futile to try to protest in the way that protests took place before. That's an unfortunate lesson. I don't think that the present situation is sustainable, but certainly protests haven't panned out in the way that people had hoped they would earlier.
Samer Shahata from the University of Oklahoma speaking with us about Egypt's government pardoning political activist Alaa Abd El Fattah.
We recently told you about the dire economic situation in Malawi, one of Africa's least developed nations. The state of the economy was on people's minds as they voted in a presidential election last week. Yesterday, Malawi's Electoral Commission said it will not be pressured to declare a winner until it has completed a proper count of votes. Partial results were released yesterday, though, and they show former President Peter Mutharika with a strong lead. The winner must receive more than 50% of the total vote, or there will be a runoff election.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will be back tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.